This is Bill Teeple, Alan Cobb, and Donna Colby, broadcasting from Icon Gallery in the Cultural District in the square of Fairfield, Iowa. Welcome to Icon Art Radio. Okay, Donna, what have you got to read to us?
Well, this is just another quote from this wonderful book called Picasso on Art. I like Picasso quotes as jumping off points for the radio show because he was a man of opposites. Pretty much any Picasso quote you can find another Picasso quote where he says the exact opposite. One of my favorite opposites is that he's quite famous for saying, I only find, I never seek. I never research. And then there's another quote saying, all I ever do in my work is research. And he explains why that's true. So, but just about any topic at all, you'll find him going back and forth because that's what he did. He explored all the possibilities. So anyway, this quote, I was just leafing through, and this quote just popped out at me as a good topic to talk about. The little category in the book is art as legend. And what Picasso said was, I think this is somebody quoting Picasso or talking about Picasso. Later, he used to say quite often, paper lasts quite as well as paint, and after all, if it all ages together, why not? And he said further, after all, later, no one will see the picture, they will see the legend of the picture, the legend that the picture has created. Then it makes no difference if the picture lasts or does not last. Later they will restore it. A picture lives by its legend, not by anything else.
So, that's cool.
Let's see where we can go with that. I can actually go a little...
Yeah, keep going.
Because I can refer to last week's show. If you were listening to last week's show about children's book illustrators, and one of the publishers we mentioned was Green Tiger Press, and one of the prominent artists that they produced in their cards and books and all was a contemporary artist of the 60s named Cooper Edens, who did very almost Yellow Submarine-ish type drawings, paintings. And Bill, you told the story about how you at that time were also doing art for you and Lynn, we're doing art for Green Tiger Press, and because you had been to art school, you were very conscious of producing archival quality paintings and all that, and this guy, Cooper Edens, who just like took off and became phenomenally popular back then, did his little paintings on shirt cardboards.
That's right.
And what was your reaction to that?
Well, you know, a real serious artist would never do that. Only my reaction was that I was watching him have many more sales than we were having with his cardboard art. And so I actually learned a lesson there, that it's like going for it is much more important than doing it in the proper fashion.
Mm. And he did become a legend of the 60s.
He was a legend of the 60s, yeah, and we weren't. Well, in
you
small
sort of
way.
Were too.
We were right in the fairy thing, which will be a future show. We're going to try to get Lynn here, and we'll talk about that. I think the iconic nature of the work of art is possibly the most significant part of it. It opens up a portal to somewhere deep inside us, a mythic realm, a road to the source itself. You can't, once a painting's become famous, you can't see it any longer fresh.
Can't.
It's become an icon, and it represents all kinds of things, and people then pin all their own baggage onto it, so it gets more and more baggage. Mm. Its greatness is often in its simple access to something that is universal for all of us, so that never goes away. But at the same time, everyone sees it. They talk about that in their own way and how it affects them and what it ticks off in them, and all of those commentaries get tacked to it. it gets more and more like a juggernaut that's moving and picking up more speed gradually, and more stuff gets piled on.
Well, and legends, I think, help people to like what they think they're supposed to like. You know, like the Mona Lisa. Everybody goes to see the Mona Lisa because it's this legendary painting. And, you know, like you were just saying, I doubt if anybody just innocently stands there and, you know, evaluates what they're seeing. They're instead going, "Ah, the Mona Lisa." And this just fills them with awe that they're standing in front of this famous work of art. And what we noticed in traveling all over Europe a few years ago was that many people in the museums where you were allowed to take photographs, many people were more concerned with having their photograph taken with the famous painting than with standing there and really tuning into the painting. You know, they would just quickly go and position themselves and so that they could prove, "I was in the presence of this legendary painting."
So this is bringing up something else. This is bringing up the getting energy off a power object. Hmm. You know, why do people want the autograph of a famous person? Or why do people get all sort of like giddy and strange being even near a famous person? Or they go to Los Angeles, first thing they think about is like, how can I see a star?
Yeah.
And what is it, I mean, this is raising a question. What is it that people are getting out of that? Why do they feel so, that their life is so insignificant that they need to be in the presence of some kind of a power person or object to, and they get really high at the idea of being in that situation.
Mm. Yeah, it is kind of strange. The first time I went to L.A., I was in an elevator, and Martin Balsam was in the elevator. And he was not, by any means, like a favorite movie star of mine or anything. I barely knew what he'd ever been in, but I just recognized him. And it was that instantaneous reaction. It's like I got out of the elevator. It's like, "Ah, that was Martin Balsam," you know. And I don't even think I remembered his name, actually, at first. It was like, "That was that guy," because it does, yeah, I don't know what it is. It's,
well, I think it has to do with the way memory works. When we remember something that's merely factual and we are only just remembering it for the first time, it is a lot like a sort of snapshot of an experience. But each time you remember it, you add the experience of remembering it to this stack of memories of that original thing. And when you see a movie star and you see him or her in a movie and then in another movie and another movie, you're stacking up this tremendous amount of connections, this huge quantity of connections to all sorts of other experiences. So when the face becomes a symbol or a trigger. I mean, our memory is primarily associative. It's not alphabetic or numerical or something. We remember things by whatever connection got made. So you have this one human face, which is, of course, infinitely detailed, and we're really talented at recognizing them, that's tied to a vast spectrum of connections, whereas most faces are not. Or they're tied to an entire family thing. I mean, if you suddenly saw a family member you hadn't seen in 25 years, it'd be even more exciting.
Yeah, that's true, right.
But you see this person that you know, was Moses and, you know, an acrobat and 50 million other, you know, things, and all of the experiences you had while you were watching the movie and when you saw the movie and what part of your life it was, and all those things are tied to that face. So you know, you walk into the movie and into the theater and you see Charlton Heston in the lobby and you think, "My God, it's something, it's not a person, it's a piece of my own history that's standing right in front of me."
That is so
well,
cool.
Well, your step, I mean, it is a matter of like the mythic realm inside you suddenly in front of you.
Yeah. And I think that's how the mythic realm gets built to some extent, is from these accumulated experiences that when you overlay them, they have certain portions that are in common and they get reinforced. Mm. And the sections that are not in common cancel each other out till eventually you have this strange three-dimensional relief map of significance.
So that also explains why what we were talking about last week about the odd Thursday with the children's book illustration and what happened in the room where everybody had that same kind of sort of giddy feeling, you know, with encountering these images. That's what it was, that those pictures that we were looking at on the wall referred back in our memory to probably hundreds of times when we looked at those exact books as children. And that's so interesting because one of the books, I still actually have a little golden book that I had back in the 50s called The Rainy Day Playbook. And it was one of my favorite books about some kids who it's raining out and they can't go outside to play. And so what are they going to do to keep themselves entertained in the house? And
Watch TV.
It goes through in this book like all of my favorite things to do. You know, they played school. They played cars and trucks. They made paper dolls. They, you know, and one thing after another. And the illustrations in that book were so much like my actual life as a child, as well as it being my favorite book, that even now, if I open up that book, I almost have to cry. Mm. I feel this feeling in my heart that's like almost unbearable because the familiarity and affection for those images is so incredibly strong. Yeah. But that's so interesting, that explanation about the memory.
Because as kids, you read them over and over again, and those images really get indelibly set in your brain.
Well, and that book, it wasn't just about the images in the book. It was because the actual images in the book also referred to the things that I did over and over again as a child. So there's like a double. I mean, what you were describing, Alan, about all the associations. There were probably so many associations with that particular book that
it's
much more powerful.
It represents life at home.
Fascinating. Wow.
I've recently been seeking out and acquiring some of my favorite children's books. There was one called Vavash, the cow who could paint pictures with her tail. And there was one image from that book where she dresses up as a ghost, or I can't even remember quite how it works, but there's this image of a sort of sheet-draped figure floating in the air with the head of a cow or a bull or something, and she's scaring off the bad farmer from next door or some silly thing. And that image had a scary quality to it. They're pen and ink drawings, and I've always remembered that image. And I bought the book just so that I could look at that image again and see, you know, what chords it strikes nowadays. And ironically, it wasn't in the book. The image is missing from the book. And it turns out it was taken out of the book because it scared some of the readers. And so they censored the artist's illustrations. And I was really annoyed. I had a first edition of it, and the one that I just bought off of Amazon is also a first edition according to the frontispiece, but it doesn't have that picture in it.
Isn't that? Or are you sure somebody didn't just tear out that page because it was
their
favorite one?
I looked very carefully at it's sewn signatures, and you can see that they're, you know, it's just missing.
Whoa! So somehow during the course of the first edition.
Well, it couldn't possibly be the first edition.
It could be first edition has several different printings of the
I think the first printing is the first edition. I could be wrong, but. The other book that I got recently was I think it's the first book that Dr. Seuss published. My aunt, the librarian who lived in our household, picked it up. As soon as it came out, she recognized it as being wonderful. And it's just this little, tiny, unassuming book called And to think that I saw it on Mulberry Street.
That's a great one.
It's just, right. This kid is, you know, nobody ever listens to him at home. They just ignore him. And he's on his way home from school, and he sees a donkey pulling a cart. And he starts thinking about what he's going to tell his people at home about what he saw, because he thinks it's interesting. And he realizes they won't think it's interesting unless, you know, he dresses it up a little. So he starts dressing it up, and each time you turn the page, the donkey has turned into a horse, and then it has turned into a pair of horses, and then it's like a team of horses, and what it's pulling goes from a little cart to a big wagon, to a fancy carriage, to a chariot, to a gigantic organ, steam organ bearing circus wagon surrounded by dancing performers and, you know, herds of circus animals and stuff. And it gets more and more colorful. I think it's like a two-color book. I think there's like color besides black. And then when he finally gets home, of course, they say, "What'd you see?" And he said, "Well, I saw a donkey pulling a cart." He says, "Well, that's nice."
Yeah, and that's one of those books that has been continually in print since it first came out.
Oh, yeah.
It's just they're still producing. You know, it was my kids loved that book. And Dr. Seuss, he was producing children's books for 50 years.
Yeah.
And they just were popular with all of those kids of all of those succeeding generations. It really shows he tapped into what kids like.
Oh, he was amazing.
But he touched in on something that everybody, the adults that read it, the kids that read it, I mean, immediately you had this attachment and attraction to.
Well, and that goes back to what you were saying at the beginning of last week's show about why people want to produce children's art, you know, these illustrators. And it's because you said that the boundary, they don't have the boundaries of the serious art world, and so they can let their imaginations really flow more naturally. And he certainly had no barriers to his.
Right. Oobleck.
What?
Oobleck.
Yeah, that was Bartholomew.
One of my favorite Cummins.
And Oobleck.
Yeah, one of the Bartholomew.
Even now, I will identify in class color as Oobleck green.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Well, and that actually, from looking right now, I can have the experience of looking at that book and having feeling what that green was doing to my awareness.
That's the only color in that book.
That's right.
It's a black and white book with green. It's astonishing that he managed to do in that series of books. Because it just, every single one of them is a classic. I don't think there are any, lost and forgotten titles.
Right, yeah, I think that would...
I mean, he connected with his muse.
Yeah.
And wrote it.
And here's an interesting distinction I was just thinking of. You know how we were talking at the beginning of this show about legend, art as legend, and how a famous painting like the Mona Lisa or something you can barely have an instant reaction to because you're just so caught up in the legend. But somehow, I don't think that's true of these children's books.
No, it's not.
Dr. Seuss is obviously a great legend as a children's book illustrator, and so are all those books. But when you read The Cat in the Hat, you're totally there each time. You're not just tapping into it because it's a legend.
And the kids, it's one generation after another experiencing it for the first time, so they're not bringing any of that baggage to the thing. And I think just the delight of the limericks and the poetry and the humor, it just, you just say yes again and again.
And the goofy drawings have their...
it wouldn't be the same without the drawing. I mean, the drawings make it. I mean, and they take you to his Dr. Seuss land,
Right.
Well, also, there's, you were talking earlier about the archetypal images and how children's books, all kinds of children, tap into those themes, real mythic themes. And maybe that's the key, that maybe we can only have an innocent, spontaneous reaction to things that are deeply universal like that. And the kind of art that we can't do that with, and that we are attracted to just because the person has been really famous and that painting has been really famous, are possibly ones that are more contemporary to their day and not so universal, and so they don't have that kind of instantaneous deep effect on us. What do you think of that?
Well, the serious art is caught up in cultural transformation and psychology, and it's so dense.
Yeah.
A work like Guernica or The Women of Avignon, I mean, these things were emblematic of transformation of consciousness in culture, and that's one of the reasons that they carry such weight as symbols, icons, through it. So it's definitely very different from children's book illustration.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know that there is an iconography of children's illustration, but I don't think I see it as being terribly archetypal. A lot of it seems to be very, you know, culturally positioned and stuff. It's the stories, maybe, in their
I think I was referring
morality.
To the stories, maybe, when I was saying that you're tuning into stories that have a pattern that is recognizable, with very simple, you know, good versus evil kind of, and the princess being saved from the dragon and all of that, that touch a need inside to experience that.
Well, and monsters. It's like even Maurice Sendak in his book in the 1970s, I think, he wrote that book, Where the Wild Things Are. And because there is kind of an archetypal pattern of all children being afraid of monsters they can't see. And there are so many books dealing with theme.
I mean, the archetypal may be more the storyline, because the pictures, I'll grant you, are generally odd.
Yeah.
In fact, oddness is kind of part of it. In the place, the visual places that you go, and the grim fairy tales.
Maybe that's why adults lose that freedom of imagination, is because when you get to a certain age, your books don't have pictures anymore. Your storybooks don't have pictures anymore.
Well, everything becomes increasingly judgmental and increasingly, you know, classified and categorized and pigeonholed. It's more, you know, what you're taught in school is how to categorize things.
Right, yeah.
And so then, instead of looking at the thing, you're looking at the other things to see which one it goes with. You know, which picture doesn't belong in this sequence is sort of the classic IQ test, you know, question. And, you know, it's a screwdriver and a hammer and a baseball bat and a duck. And I guess it's the duck, although if you think about it too much, it could be the baseball bat, you know. And but that's what you're being taught to do. They're trying to teach you how to think. And unfortunately, they succeed somewhat.
And maybe that's why films are so popular with adults, is because you've gone through all of these years with the text and the categories and everything, and then there's some kind of a relief of going into a theater where it's primarily visual that you're...
Well, yeah, I mean, it's more passive, there's no question about it. And it's more energetic. You know, you get overshadowed by a movie. And you can get overshadowed by a book, but you have to read it. And that doesn't seem to be happening much anymore. I must say, I subscribe to The New Yorker, and I'm still just blown away by the sheer quantity of stuff that I would read if I had time that arrives every week, relentlessly, week after week. And I have these stacks of New Yorkers that I haven't had time to read, and I would love to, but I can't even begin to catch up.
Do you think anybody actually has time to read the New Yorker cover to cover? Because I subscribed to it for years, too, and also have in my closet stacks of them that I've never finished reading, but even though they're all intriguing. But who would have time to read
Well,
that
when
much
I was growing
week?
Up, we didn't have a TV, and my aunt read them. Oh. You know, it took a week, you know, for her to read. Well, it didn't
take
a full
week. I guess that's what you did every evening.
Yeah,
if you read
instead of watch.
But it's getting less and less.
Yeah.
But I'll have to admit, I don't think I've ever read a magazine. And I get all these art magazines, and I'll read an article here or there. It's about all I have time to do. I look at the pictures, get nowadays we do so much sort of intuitive, quick grabbing of information and pigeonholing it somewhere where it belongs.
Yeah.
Making snap decisions about things based on taking in a quick visual of the situation. And I do that with the art books. I get a clue of what's going on in art in America this month by skimming through art in America.
Well, I read a tremendous amount, but it's almost all technical stuff. And what I'm doing with those books is I'm not actually reading them. I'm skimming them, looking for, a particular piece of information that's missing from my knowledge bank. And I may have to cover 2,000 pages in a couple of days just trying to find one particular piece of information. And then I'll sort of skim over the same 2,000 or 3,000 pages of material a few days or a few weeks later looking for another piece of information. And so eventually I come to know the contents of all of those books, but it's not by reading.
Well, I think that's one reason why I'm grateful for having to do Odd Thursday presentations, because Odd Thursday, we have a topic and I have to research it. And so instead of just looking at the pictures in a book about Cezanne or something, I need to read and learn about his life. And it's marvelous to have a reason, have kind of an assignment to have to read and learn and go more deeply into. I realize I have so many books at home that I haven't read thoroughly.
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.